Hello to all my fellow 101 History Podcast listeners out there. It is certainly great to be back on the air with you guys. I really have missed being on the air. Hard to believe it was probably about almost a week at best since I was on the air last, to say the least. I know it's been probably about 6 to 7 days at best, I could say, but it has been quite a while to me in terms of when I was on the air last. And I'm sure many of you were beginning to wonder when, in fact, would Kirk Monroe get back to coming on the air and getting started with a new podcast book topic series. Well, to answer your question, the answer is right now. Yes, folks, right now. And I'm glad because I know that where we're going to be going next is going to be very unique. But then again, every direction we've gone in terms of stories that we have learned about have been unique. They've been unique in their own ways. But I think this one that we're going to be embarking on is going to be probably a little bit more unique than maybe what we've done before. And I'm sure many of you are probably wondering how so. Well, I will get to that part here soon. Now, you know, today, hard to believe that we only have 2 days left of March, and that this Sunday marks Easter Sunday. I do recall that this event took place when I was really young, but I was too young to remember it. I was almost 2 years old when it happened, but tomorrow marks the 43rd anniversary of the near assassination attempt on President Ronald Reagan's life. And I know most of you are wondering, why should this be pointed out? Well, you know, I remember Ronald Reagan rather very well in terms of living under his presidency. As a matter of fact, of all the presidents that I have lived under in my lifetime, Ronald Reagan still to this day remains my favorite. He rejuvenated American confidence, American spirit, or I should say rejuvenated American patriotism. He helped restore morale to the United States military, given that we had spent a number of years over in Vietnam only to come away empty-handed, veterans not feeling welcomed, knowing that the cause that they had served for, it may not have been the most valiant cause, but knowing that soldiers came home and did not receive a proper welcome. Of course, I think it would be fair to say that had President John F. Kennedy not been assassinated, we probably would never have gotten involved in the manner that that his predecessor, Lyndon B. Johnson, chose to get the United States involved in. But I guess what I'm trying to say is that as scary as it was that Ronald Reagan was nearly assassinated, thank heavens that, number one, God was on Ronald Reagan's side, but two, when Ronald Reagan exited the building that he was coming from, leaving from, that a Secret Service agent was in front of Reagan and ultimately took a bullet, and he literally shielded himself. That was Secret Service agent Tim McCarthy. Of course, one of the bullets that John Hinckley fired did ricochet through the glass window and ultimately got Ronald Reagan. At the time, though, little did Ronald Reagan know that he had been hit. So once the Secret Service sped off, the goal was, well, the objective was to get him back to the White House. Well, Jerry Parr, or I should say the late Jerry Parr, he died about 9 years ago. He was about 85 years old. He wasn't supposed to have been on duty that day, but as they left, he took a look at Reagan just to make sure that everything was okay, and he saw that Reagan was starting to bleed. And Jerry Parr said to the driver, "Look, we gotta go with Plan B. Let's get to George Washington Hospital immediately." And so they did, and What do you know, had it not been for Jerry Parr's quick decision thinking, and had they taken Ronald Reagan back to the White House, Ronald Reagan himself probably would have died from internal bleeding. And then, and what do you know, we would have been looking at another tragedy, given that we had already experienced one 18 years earlier when President John F. Kennedy was tragically assassinated in Dallas, Texas. So I know most of us have to are wondering, why does all this matter, even after 43 years later? Well, without Ronald Reagan's leadership, I don't believe that the I think it's fair to say eventually the Soviet Union would have collapsed. But even those from within the Soviet Union knew that if there was one person whom was truly convinced that the Soviet Empire would collapse, it was none other than Ronald Reagan. To me, Ronald Reagan was my JFK. I mean, how do I say that? Because John F. Kennedy was trying to win the Cold War without firing a shot. And John F. Kennedy, along with Nikita Khrushchev and Fidel Castro, all agreed to cease hostilities. Khrushchev agreed to remove all the nuclear missiles from Havana, Cuba, being 90 miles away from Miami, Florida. I mean, this is how close we got to World War III, folks. Kennedy told Khrushchev that he would agree to have ballistic missiles removed from Turkey. And so, what do you know, folks? Peace was achieved. World War III was averted. But sadly, for some people, it just wasn't enough. And sadly, a year later, John F. Kennedy was taken from us. Well, for Ronald Reagan, I think it's fair to say that he too wanted to win the Cold War without firing a shot. But yet his objective was to ultimately see to it that the Soviets could no longer compete with the Americans in terms of an arms race, which ultimately happened. So it's fair to say that John F. Kennedy laid the groundwork for how to go about winning the Cold War without firing the shot. But by winning the Cold War, it wouldn't happen overnight, but by doing what he did in terms of issuing a naval blockade along the coast of Havana, Cuba, we were successfully able to avert World War III. Ronald Reagan, as the late Margaret Thatcher, Prime Minister of England, said, Ronald Reagan won the Cold War without firing a shot. And he was the Winston Churchill of his time. So it's fair to say that here we had a Democrat and then a Republican 18 years later working for the common good, two different generations, but yet two men whom did some great things for their time. Sadly, one man's life was cut short after 1,000 days in office. The other man's life was spared because of quick decision thinking on the part of the Secret Service agent who wasn't even supposed to have been there that day. And so therefore, I'm left to wonder, had Jerry Parr not been there that day to have saved Ronald Reagan, we would have sadly witnessed a very, very unfortunate tragedy. So because of Jerry Parr, we have him to thank, folks, for saving Ronald Reagan by ultimately saying, hey, look, we've got to get the car turned around into an immediate, go immediately to George Washington Hospital. So just be reminded, folks, that tomorrow, marking 43 years, even though that was a long time ago, but just remember how fragile even history itself is in terms of how drastic history can be altered if, say, the right people aren't at the right position at the right time to make a life-altering decision that ultimately can save the commander-in-chief's life. Well, I think it's time that we get the show on the road with where we're going in terms of our new podcast book topic series. We will be in the 19th century. We will actually start out in the 19th century, but where we go will take us into the midway point of the 19th century. But the journey itself does not end at, it does not stop in the 19th century. It's one that goes into the start of the 20th century. But I can tell you, it's all based upon what one man himself envisioned that had never been done before in the United States. We will discover that the process itself may not have had the same principles as this man had laid out, but the process itself had been experimented with prior to his arrival into the world. So here we go with our prologue, and of course at the end I will tell you all the official title of this new Book Topic podcast series. So here we go. Food preservation to chilling daily essentials from dairy products, fish, meat, fruits, and vegetables had often challenged mankind as far back as prehistory times. Prehistory times? Yes, being the period or time frame of human history which encompassed using stone tools to first historical recordings through inventing writing systems. Being able to preserve food was one thing, but attaining progress required many steps of trial and error. And I must say that in this podcast Book Topic series, there will be a lot of trial and error. But trial and error is not always a bad thing. The bigger question might be is, how much time do you have? And in this podcast book topic series, not only is it a question of how much time you have, but how can you prove the skeptics wrong? Humans in early times turned to curing as a way of preventing food spoilage, along with having access to root cellars, which served as underground facilities for storing their winter food supplies. Prior to the mid-19th century's arrival, very few Americans had means nor use behind relying on a modern-day commodity that has often been taken for granted. Now, of course, I know when I say modern-day, I'm talking like today in the present, but I think it's fair to say that most of us, when we hear about this commodity in terms of it being coined as modern day, I think it's fair to say that most of us would think that in terms of how we can go about preserving it has become more modernized than, say, 200 years ago. Well, I'll give you the answer to what this commodity is. So I'll repeat the question. I'll repeat what I just said a few minutes ago. Prior to mid-19th century's arrival, very few Americans had the means nor use behind relying on a modern-day commodity that has often been taken for granted, being ice. That's right, folks, ice. Yes, we have ice in our freezers. Yes, we can, you know, push down on a lever and ice pours into our glass. Yes, that's kind of what I'm getting at here. The primary reasons behind why so many Americans didn't turn to ice for refrigeration means revolved around lack of accessibility to ice storehouses, aka ice houses, as well as ice boxes. Ice boxes, folks, where people in colonial times or even in the 19th century, hey, even in the 20th century, people had used ice boxes as a means of preserving such perishables as butter, milk, other creams, even ice cream, maybe for that matter. Now, I will get back to talking more about refrigeration here soon. So if I'm jumping corners and all that, it's not because I've purposely forgotten where to keep going and so forth, but it's just part of the outline of what I've drafted, or what I've been, what I'm going to be talking about. Even prologues and epilogues, folks, I will say, are works of art. You have to start somewhere, and the goal would be to end somewhere on a good, thorough note. When we think of accessing ice, our first thoughts turn to the refrigerator. Refrigerators, believe it or not, folks, however, have a history that date back to the mid-18th century when a Scottish physician, chemist, and professor at Edinburgh Medical School named William Cullen designed his own refrigerator via artificial means. Wow, isn't it great to say that we've got people who are say two steps ahead of what we often think didn't get created until modern day times? Yes, I think it's great. Professor Cullen relied on a pump to establish a temporary vacuum, one from a laboratory, which ultimately yielded a small batch of ice, but overall results had no relevant significance at the time the experiment itself was first conducted. So yes, you know, you get a small batch of ice, and that's great, but it's not really anything grand, or what I would say, it's nothing really grand to gloat over, say, by everyone else, but for you, a small batch of ice is a little revolutionary. It's a revolutionary step in a small way, but it's in the right direction for what might lie ahead in the future. Scottish professor William Cullen wasn't the only scientist of his time whom went about conducting experimentations involving liquids like alcohol and ether, which had been determined to lower an object's temperature past water's freezing point at 32 degrees Fahrenheit. You know, it's interesting when I hear the word, ether and chloroform would become the first two anesthetics introduced in America. But chloroform wasn't introduced until the 1840s. Ether had been around a lot longer, but little did scientists know at the time that ether could have been administered as an anesthetic. But that wouldn't come until after the 19th century had begun in terms of coming to the realization that ether was, in fact, able to be used as an anesthetic. Well, a good example here, folks, of experimentation involving liquids like alcohol and ether in terms of being able to prove that an object's temperature could be lowered past water's freezing point at 32 degrees Fahrenheit took place in 1758. And of course, when I think of 1758, I think of the French and Indian War taking place, or what's called the Seven Years' War that goes until 1763. But the French and Indian War is just a couple of years old by the time 1758 arrives. But in the year 1758, two individuals, and believe it or not, folks, one of them was a signer to the Declaration of Independence and to the United States Constitution. That was Mr. Benjamin Franklin. We should be reminded, folks, that Benjamin Franklin was more than just a political guru. He was a scientist himself. And it's fair to say that men of that time were part of the Enlightenment. Their minds revolved around other subjects besides, you know, politics, for example. So Benjamin Franklin co-joined with a chemistry professor, or a British chemistry professor named John Hadley. These two men conducted an experiment using a mercury thermometer with the bulb itself as the main object. The bulb inside the thermometer, that is, folks, as the main object. This eventually led them to go about lowering the thermometer's bulb's temperature to where it dipped below minus 14 degrees Celsius. If you equate that to Fahrenheit, it's 7 degrees. I'd do a little research on that. Nothing wrong with that, especially if you want to make the point that I would like to make to you all here momentarily. So by lowering the thermometer bulb's temperature to minus 14 degrees Celsius, 7 degrees Fahrenheit, shortly afterwards, Benjamin Franklin and John Hadley spotted a thin layer of ice, roughly 1/4 inches thick, forming around the thermometer's bulb's surface. How about that, folks? A thin layer of ice is forming. It's 1/4 inches thick around the thermometer bulb's surface. What Franklin and Hadley performed was nothing random. Okay, this isn't anything, you know, like for like a school project kind of thing, but rather instead their purpose aimed to capture heat, or I should say energy, that got absorbed or released during a substance's phase change, or what we call latent heat. Latent heat being heat converting a solid into a liquid or gas, or liquid into gas without changing the temperature. So this was something rather revolutionary that these two men conducted, to say the least. Now, it's often very easy to assume that human access towards acquiring a lucrative commodity such as ice had been taking place for just 200 years, from early to mid-19th century into the present day. This is where most of us, not most of us, I would say all of us, are going to be taken by real surprise with how far back ice itself goes in terms of how civilizations acquired ice, but how they went about preserving essentials that required to be preserved through using ice. And of course, when I think of ice from, say, what do you call it, from in terms of evolution, or ice from a geological standpoint, I think of the ice ages that occurred, say, given the last ice age occurred about, say, between 10, 15,000 years ago. And one thing, I've probably mentioned this before, when my wife and I were in Ohio last summer on vacation, we visited some of the Lake Erie Islands, two of them, I should say, being Kelly's Island and South Bass Island, home to Put-in Bay. But at Kelly's Island, there are the glacial grooves that, believe it or not, folks, date back to the last ice age, 10, 15,000 years ago. It was the known as the Wisconsin glacial period. And the irony to it all is that the glacial grooves that you see a large section of them. Why do I say just a large section? Well, believe it or not, folks, years ago, when the population of Kelly's Island was much higher, there was a quarry mining company at the island. And so the miners were mining for natural resources, and so they stumbled upon what they thought was, you know, like a pit or a shaft. And so they started digging away at the glacial grooves, but little did they know that they were digging, that they were tearing apart tearing apart something geologically that had been around for in existence for between 10-15,000 years. Eventually they realized that what they were digging, or what they were trying to do, was not related to what they did work-wise. So the Ohio Department of Natural Resources and what do you call it, I guess preservation it was, came in and held off and stopped all further work. And of course, the quarry mining company agreed to it as well. So basically, what is left of the glacial grooves at Kelly's Island has been preserved for quite some time and is a natural landmark. So, yes, it's easy for all of us to think that when, you know, with regards to ice in terms of ancient times, it's easy to think about the ice ages that occurred. But we should be reminded that even in the Ice Ages, mankind did exist. He was hunting, most notably, woolly mammoths. And of course, woolly mammoths along with some other animals, did go extinct after the Ice Age ended, and that partly was probably due to the fact that those creatures had relied on the ice so much to get from points A to point B that when it was no longer accessible to them, those creatures were simply just not able to adapt. And not to get too off track, but it is fair to say that even in today's time, we're still dealing with issues on a much greater level with loss of sea ice, more so than what had happened in the last ice age. So anyways, you all would be very surprised to know this, but ironically, the means behind acquiring ice have been known, according to historians, to date as far back as 1000 BC. I was blown away at that, folks. I really was. Ancient civilizations like Greece and Rome saw their peoples dig large snow pits. I know, it's kind of crazy to think that ancient Rome, people living in ancient Greece and ancient Rome actually had snow, considering that's southern Europe. Yeah, believe it or not, those areas at one time would have seen snow. Of course, you know, we should be reminded in today's time that even modern-day Italy to the north, northern Italy, is more likely to receive snow than, say, southern Italy. But ancient civilizations like Greece and Rome saw their peoples dig large snow pits insulated with grass or through using tree branches as a primary method for cooling their beverages versus preserving foods. Why would you probably want to cool beverages more versus preserving foods? Could it be that the beverages that you want to cool and preserve, you would want them to last longer, given that, say, you may not be able to have those beverages on a yearly basis? Could it be that certain beverages you might only be able to have certain times of the year, and the only way to preserve them is to go about preserving the snow pits in terms with the ice and insulate it with grass or tree branches? But by doing all that, you would be able to help ensure that what you enjoyed could last longer, even if it's only on a even if it's not something that you can enjoy on a yearly basis. Because we do have to be reminded, folks, that throughout history, for a great deal of history, that is, not everyone ate foods that so many of us eat on a regular basis. Mankind has not always been able to eat foods whenever he's wanted to eat them, regardless of the season. In other words, in colonial days, you would have been eating meats like roast beef, say venison. You probably would have been eating more of that during the winter time. We didn't have supermarkets like we do today, where we can go and buy whatever it is we want to buy regardless of the season, and it will always be there. We have to remember that ancient civilizations, even into colonial times, not everyone could have access to any kind of food that they wanted, regardless of the season. But other ancient civilizations had their own procedures for cooling water to preserving ice. Egyptian society turned to cooling water through means of evaporation. Evaporation being the process where a liquid gets turned into a gas. The Egyptians placed jars on the roofs of their houses during the night. The Persians placed ice into a pit known as Yakakal. I know most of you have probably never heard of Yakakal before. That's spelled Y-A-K-H-C-H-A-L, Yakakal. Yakakal is an ice house whose structures had a dome-like shape above ground, climates went from one extreme to another, being cold to hot. So we're looking at extreme cold, and then we're looking at extreme hot. No in between. Yaka calls also stored food, but during the hot summer season, they served multiple purposes, from preserving food to making desserts like sorbets. I did not know that sorbet, folks, was something that the Persians introduced. So we should always be reminded that just because we buy stuff here in the United States, it doesn't always mean that Americans created it. When it comes to hearing about bodies of water from lakes, rivers, to ponds becoming totally frozen, our first thoughts center around areas whose climates are driven by cold, frigid weather pattern systems. In the United States, places or areas which frequently come first to my mind in regards to bodies of water freezing are the Great Lakes and New England regions. Over time, ice itself as a frozen commodity would undergo something so radical that very few people, most notably those with money readily available to spend, truly lacked means for envisioning long-term success behind transporting the material itself from within the greater United States, including places overseas. Yes, I think we do have to be reminded that even for those people whom have money readily available to spend, it doesn't mean that they will probably want to go along with your investment or go along with your proposed ideas. You know, think of it as kind of like the modern day television show Shark Tank. You know, a contestant or a candidate goes into the tank and is trying to pitch a sale for some kind of new creation or invention or something that, you know, he or she's trying to woo a shark into. They may have all the right stuff, but the question is, are the sharks going to go along with it? Is it something they want to invest their money in? So, as I mentioned earlier, you know, we're going to be learning about a particular individual whom wants to do something really grand involving ice. But the big question could be at this moment is he going to be able to team up with people within his confines whom would go along with this investment? We'll have to find out here soon. What I also found interesting regarding Europeans and the commodity of ice is that Europeans, for one, came to the New World for various reasons. Well, when I think of Europeans coming over to the New World for various reasons, if I had to pick one, it would be many of them came over here to avoid religious persecutions. Though, when I think of those people wanting to avoid religious persecutions, I think of the Pilgrims, whom left England to eventually settle in what we know as Plymouth Rock. They wanted complete separation of church and state. They did not want to have anything to do with the Church of England. As for the Puritans, whom came to Jamestown, they wanted to reform the Anglican Church from within by modifying it, but they were also very staunchly devoted Anglicans, to where they did not want any... They didn't want anything drastic to happen in terms of complete separation from church and state, but they still wanted to cling on to their Anglican beliefs and values, but just doing so in a little bit more modified matter that would not upset the hierarchy structure. So yes, Europeans came to the New World for various reasons, but ice... Believe it or not, folks, ice itself had a very unique place amongst well-to-do Europeans. How so? Well, for those Europeans whom are well-to-do, you know, I think it'd be fair to say that they are part of the gentry. And of course, I have to be reminded when it comes to the gentry, you know, I'm always under the assumption that they are in the elite-most group of the gentry, but I have been told from other historic places that I've visited that gentry itself actually has three tiers. There is the lower gentry, you have middle gentry, and then you have upper gentry. The upper gentry could be within that 5% threshold. That just to give you a random number. I don't know how accurate that is, but that's just my give and take right there. But for well-to-do Europeans, they found ice to be an incredible luxury. How so? Well, for one, they went about building ice houses as a means for storing ice gathered along their estates during during winter time, most notably the winters from 16th century and onward. And by building ice houses, the wealthy, or I should say the elite, use them as a means for cooling foods as well as beverages. So ice houses, folks, were, I've seen some ice houses, pictures of ice houses, and they're big, but not all ice house structures are the same. And depending on the size of the ice house itself, the size of the ice house alone can also determine how much ice the structure itself can accommodate. And of course, I know many of you are still wondering, how in the world could this ice be preserved, given that there's no such thing as modern day refrigeration that we know today, and yet can still take for granted if we're not careful? Well, the United States, come the start of the 19th century, beginning around the first decade, witnessed various unique firsts. How so? Well, the first unique first, if that's even the right way to phrase it, but the first thing that I thought was unique in terms of an example had to do with, on a political note, the year 1800 marked the first time that that an election was taking place in the new century, being the 19th century, but it was also a time of transitioning when the Capitol got relocated from Philadelphia to Washington, D.C. 10 years earlier, Congress had enacted the Residency Act of 1790, which gave Philadelphia the seat of America's capital for 10 years until 1800, when it would be relocated to Washington, D.C. And this was largely done in part because the Federalists, or those from up north, were it was part of a compromise where the Northerners were able to get the National Bank, or what we might think of as a modern-day Federal Reserve, and the Southerners, in turn, were able to get the capital relocated south to Washington, D.C., which was more of a halfway line or halfway area between north and south. Well, think of it, folks, as like the modern-day Mason-Dixon line separating north and south. But in 1801, something very unique does take place involving the transfer of political power. For the first time, one political party is going to go about transferring the power of from which the outgoing party is leaving, and transferring the power over to the new party. Our first two presidents were Federalists. Matter of fact, our first two presidents, yes, were Federalists. They were the only two that were Federalists, George Washington and John Adams. So in March of 1801, and we have to remember, folks, even up until about 1933, presidents were inaugurated in March. So in March of 1801, a unique first occurred when outgoing Federalist President John Adams went about transferring power to the Democratic Republican Party under incoming President Thomas Jefferson. And yes, our country survived that, given that it was a very challenging period of time, but we survived the transfer of power and did so peacefully without violence. A year later, in 1802, another unique first happened when West Point got established as the United States' first military academy institution of higher academical learning for those men seeking to answer their call of duty. And in 1803, the first state got admitted into the Union during the 19th century, that is. In 1803, Ohio was admitted into the Union as the 17th state. And this was important, folks, because for Ohio to be admitted into the state, into the United States as a nation, Ohio was part of the old Northwest Territory, of what we think of as, you know, not only as Ohio, but Indiana, Illinois, Michigan, Wisconsin, and at one time, Northeast Minnesota was considered part of the Northwest Territory, but Ohio was carved out as the first official state to be admitted into the Union from the old Northwest Territory, and Ohio obviously set the bar for what would lie ahead. Of course, America did have to fight a second war for independence, but even after the War of 1812 ended, the remaining territories, Indiana and Illinois, would soon be admitted into the Union after 1815. But Ohio set the precedent that which helped pave the way for future westward settlement within the old Northwest Territory. Let's forward to the year 1806, given that year itself marked the end of Meriwether Lewis and William Clark's westward expansion, which had begun 2 years earlier on May 14, 1804, along the present-day Illinois-Missouri line. While this event rightfully garnered proper support, given America's territory had doubled thanks to Louisiana Purchase acquisition from 1803, 3 years earlier, the year 1806 brought something grand to one person, a New Englander, whom sought to revolutionize how ice, once harvested from Massachusetts's ponds, lakes, and rivers, could go about getting exported domestically and internationally. The gentleman whom envisioned this grand master plan was Frederick Tudor, whose family ties were part of Boston, Massachusetts's upper elite class, better known as the Brahmins. Brahmins spelled B-R-A-H-M-I-N-S. The Boston Brahmins were white Anglo-Saxon Protestants whose ancestral lineage roots were traced back all the way to early 17th century when English people established first settlements in the New World. You know, the Brahmins are their own little elite clique. They are only going to cater to those whom are, as I said earlier, Protestant faith. Could it be that they cater to besides, say, Episcopalians? Do you think they might cater to Baptists or Presbyterians? Perhaps. But what I do know is that the Brahmins, being top of the line, do frown upon another particular group of people, most notably Irish Catholics. And the only reason I know this, not to get off track, but it is something, if any of you all are interested in wanting to learn more about the Brahmins, the Irish Catholics were frowned upon just because the Brahmins did not like the fact that that the Catholics, for years, had pretty much run the show in terms of controlling land, telling people what to believe, what not to believe, basically jailing people whom challenged the church's doctrines or beliefs. And while, yes, this all took place, the Protestants probably, on one hand, probably didn't have a whole lot of room maybe to talk themselves, but the bottom line is that Irish Catholics were excluded from the inner circle. And there was a particular family two families in Boston whom were of Irish Catholic faith, and they were the Kennedys and the Fitzgeralds. John F. Kennedy's maternal grandfather was I don't know what his first name was, but he went by the nickname of Honey Fitz. Rose Kennedy's father, whom was the mayor of Boston for a number of years. And then Joseph P. Kennedy Sr.'s father being Mr. Patrick Kennedy, whom was a saloon keeper and very involved with Boston politics. It would have to take the Kennedys to not only challenge the establishment within the Brahmins' inner circle, but come 1952, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, when he ran for the Senate, defeated a fellow member of the Brahmin inner circle named Henry Cabot Lodge. And so therefore, folks, the tide had shifted. In other words, the Brahmins were no longer invincible. And that people from another religious faith actually were able to go head to toe with them and basically say, hey, we can compete with you guys. And now, you know, the times have changed. So if you want to learn more about the Brahmins, just think of them as those who are elite, white Anglo-Saxon Protestants whom pretty much sadly did frown upon everybody else that stood in their way. But also, you know, be reminded of the fact that there were other Massachusetts families like the Kennedys and the Fitzgeralds who found ways to fight the system and be able to go head to toe with the inner Brahmin circle. But let's continue on to where we need to get to in order to wrap up the prologue. Just a year earlier in 1805, during the summer, young Frederick Tudor, at age 22, along with older brother William, had embarked on a journey southward to the Caribbean. Once the brothers returned northward back home to Boston, Massachusetts, Frederick Tudor himself realized that he could, in fact, establish an enterprise behind exporting ice from Massachusetts's inland waters. Wow. A grand idea here. I like where he's going. The bigger question is everybody else going to go along with it? Too often when learning about famous inventions like Thomas Edison's light bulb, for example, we instantly get caught up in the success element or the mode factor, which focuses on all things positive. But yet we forget to be reminded of past trial and error experiments. So in other words, you know, we learn about an invention that happened. We always have this tendency to think, well, wow, this guy must have struck gold overnight. Wishful thinking, folks. No, a lot of inventors, they pretty much almost spent their whole life savings trying to get something right, and not only master it right, but not so much by mastering it rightfully, but by ensuring that what they invented would last for future generations to come. So yes, Thomas Edison invented the light bulb in the late 1880s. And, you know, that wasn't that long ago. But yet, you know, we shouldn't take electricity for granted. We should be reminded that electricity actually did exist before Thomas Edison was alive. If we were living in colonial times, we carried a candle around at nighttime just to check on our loved ones before, say, going to bed. So by holding a candle with you, that was almost like the equivalent of carrying a modern-day flashlight, just so that you could see what was in front of you in terms of your presence. Well, what if I told you all, my fellow 101 History podcast listeners, that Frederick Tudor's ambitious dreams behind establishing an ice trade industry... That's right, folks, an ice trade industry got scoffed by people from every corner, most notably his family, including those within Boston's established elite group, the Brahmins. I thought all the people from within the Brahmin inner circle liked each other. Well, they did. I think it's fair to say that they usually did, but in regards to this grand... proposal in terms of an ice trade, I'm sure many within the Brahmin inner circle are probably laughing to themselves and thinking, has this guy lost his mind? Is he really gonna invest money? Who is he gonna seek as an investor? And who's to say that we're gonna get any solid returns out of this? Well, Frederick Tudor's story must be told from all sides regarding his ultimate quest in pursuing an industry where ice as a commodity could and did get proven over time to be worthy of getting transported into tropical climates, regions where those people were needing something cold to preserve their foods and beverages, both short and long term. Okay, folks, so think about it. What Frederick Tudor wants to do is not only to just transport ice from one section of the United States to the other, but he wants to go overseas. He really has it in his mind that there are plenty of people living elsewhere in the world who would give anything in the world to have a commodity that they can't, that for one, they might not be able to get their hands on, but two, by having this commodity, it will help their economies short and long term, probably more so long term, but it will help their economies find better solutions towards preserving foods and beverages that, say, did not have much success beforehand with long-term preservation. Our new journey per this series will include learning about Frederick's first shipment of ice and what the end results entailed, to few factors starting out on his side once the endeavor itself began, to his experimenting with multiple types of insulation, to even spending a brief period of time in jail, to designing ice house structures, to forming partnerships with other Bostonians whom, like Frederick himself, looked for ways to reinvent the current ice trade practice. This is pretty revolutionary, folks. These are just some of the many factors that we will explore behind how Frederick Tudor started off, you know, thinking grand, and then perhaps discovering that he probably saw more errors versus true successes, but how he kept persistently going even when the odds were against him. I should also point out that we will at some point in this book topic series learn about the different tools that were used to go about cutting ice from the lakes, rivers, and ponds of Massachusetts. We will also learn about how the ice got transported onto the ships. We should also probably learn as to whether or not other commodities were shipped with ice, but something tells me that perhaps it was probably not a smart idea to put other commodities on the same ship with the ice. After all, doesn't ice need to be separate? Sure. After all, does ice require a special treatment? Yes. I mean, ice does require special treatment even in today's time. But even in the 19th century, when we're talking about transporting a valuable and precious commodity like ice from a cold climate to a tropical climate, yeah, there's going to be a lot of logistics that will be required. And that's going to be required of us to learn as much as there is possible about the overall logistics behind making this dream a successful reality. Well, folks, the title to this new podcast book topic series is the following: The Frozen Water Trade, How Ice from New England Lakes Kept the World Cool. Yes, folks, kept the world cool. We will learn, folks, that maybe I shouldn't give this away, but I'll tell you now. We will learn how Frederick Tudor ultimately succeeded in getting ice not just from points A to B in the United States, but how he ultimately, literally, folks, how he ultimately got ice transported from Massachusetts all the way down to the Caribbean, the West Indies, as well as to a region 16,000 miles away, Calcutta, India. That's right, folks. In order to really understand this story, we need to know, yes, how Frederick Tudor started, Yes, we have to know all the trials and errors of success and failures. But in the end, we also will need to know just how big his grand envisions were and how they did succeed by going as far east across the Atlantic Ocean as India. Well, this is going to be a great one, folks. It really will be. And I'm glad that you all are along for the ride to enjoy it. Well, that covers this podcast episode of the prologue to The Frozen Water Trade, How Ice from New England Lakes Kept the World Cool by Gavin Waitman. That's who the author is, folks, Gavin Waitman. I did not know anything about him until he wrote this book. And believe it or not, folks, I had, and I'm sure many of you are wondering, what made you want to write a book about the frozen water trade? Well, I have visited historic places and have seen ice houses. And so I took it upon myself to do some research online, and I typed in, back in the fall of last year, ice history books. And what do you know? This book came up. And so my folks were kind enough to give it to me as a Christmas gift, and I read it not too long ago, and after reading it, I said to myself, hey, my fellow listeners should be educated on this. But then again, any of us should, because it's so easy to take certain commodities for granted, but yet we have to be reminded that people did find ways to preserve foods and beverages, but the process itself was one that took a lot of trial and error. It took time, but it also took time to perfect, and that also meant generations got better over time. Well, thank you, as always, for listening, and I look forward to being back on the air with you guys when the next time I come on the air. Now, when I'm on the air again next, we're going to talk a little bit about Frederick's upbringing, Frederick Tudor's upbringing. In other words, we're going to learn about where he starts as a young man, and we'll be kind of surprised to learn about where he's supposed to go. And we might actually be surprised if he steers off course more than once. And of course, I know some of us are thinking to ourselves, when we're steering off course, that's a bad thing. But it turns out that for Frederick, he is one determined man. And yet, some of us could say, as we learn more about him, that he's also a bit stubborn. But yet, his persistence does pay off, even in the darkest of challenges that lie ahead for him. Well, wherever you all may live, continue to stay safe and have a great Easter holiday. Take care.